Welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. There are more than 2.3 million American veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Here in San Luis Obispo County, veterans make up close to 10% of our population. Reports suggest that some 20% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, and or depression, and it's believed that at least 50% of those don't seek treatment. In today's show, we'll discuss what PTSD is, its causes and symptoms, how it affects those around the sufferer, how common it is among veterans and those still on active duty, and what, if anything, can be done to help, and where help is offered and how to access it. I'm joined today by David Dorfmeyer, Vietnam veteran, retired Army Sergeant Major, and clinical therapist with personal and professional interest in service members suffering from PTSD. Also with me is Liz Graves, mental health therapist at SLO County Behavioral Health and a spouse of a U.S. Army combat veteran. And a little later in the show, Michael Young, the team leader at the SLO Vets Center, will be joining us by phone. Michael is also an adjunct lecturer at USC and a military social worker. Of course, Central Coast Voices is a participatory show, and you're part of our discussion each week. You can bring your voice into the conversation by calling us at 781-3875 with questions or comments pertaining to today's show. And I want to thank you, David and Liz, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure
to be here.
Great. Well, you know, the first thing I think to start with is the basics of post-traumatic stress disorder, and we hear so much about it now. New phenomenon? New thing?
No, not at all. It's as old as the history of man, and one can find symptoms related to PTSD in the writing of the Iliad and the Odyssey that Homer wrote, some 2,000 years ago. It is a diagnosis that has only come into public awareness as late as 1980 with the classification in the DSM-3. The diagnosis is applicable to people who have been exposed to traumatic events that are life-threatening. And from a clinical perspective, it's an anxiety disorder. It's an Axis I anxiety disorder. But Jonathan Shea is a psychiatrist who wrote the book Achilles in Vietnam, and he says that post-traumatic stress disorder is debilitating because of the loss of authority over memory and the undoing of character. And we can get into more explanation as we proceed on into the program.
Okay. And Liz, you're with San Luis Obispo County Mental Health. And,
yes.
And you're specifically working with veterans and their families.
Right. So I see veterans and their families on a daily basis, and I'm providing treatment to veterans. you know, majority struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, but also struggling with depression and anxiety symptoms as well. You know, they all kind of go hand in hand. So yes, that's something that I see very often.
And we're going to have Michael joining us, and he's going to be talking about what services the SLO Vet Center offer. The difference, I think, between County Behavioral Health Services and the SLO Vet Center, you're offering services to the veteran and their family as a unit, correct?
Right. And yes, I believe the Vet Center as well, which Mike can talk about it more, does involve the family as well. But one difference is that at County Behavioral Health, we're allowed to work with all veterans, combat or non-combat veterans. So the Vet Center is specifically for combat veterans and for military sexual trauma.
Okay. And then, so David, talk a little bit about PTSD. I mean, what does it look like? What is the effect?
Sure. Well, back in the late 70s, clinicians were noticing that there was a similarity between veterans returning from Vietnam, people who had experienced natural disasters, individuals who had experienced trauma as a result of automobile accidents or personal assaults, and most notably rapes. And what they discovered is that there was a commonality. And so based on that awareness, the American Psychiatric Association formally recognized the disorder that we now refer to as PTSD back in 1980. But it's important for people in the audience to know that while we're talking about veterans today in this program, there are probably more people who have been in automobile accidents or personally assaulted who carry this diagnosis, who suffer from this disorder, than there are combat veterans. Mm-hmm. Now, what does it look like? Well, for purposes of this program, I thought about making a distinction between observable symptoms versus what's non-observable. And the observable symptoms will be irritability, moodiness, hypervigilance, emotional volatility, a mistrust of others. And let me just say that the reason people feel this way is because the central issue as a result of being traumatized is a disruption of one's belief system about themselves, the nature of the universe, and whether or not they can feel safe in the world.
And is it also about whether we can control?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. So the issue of control is central to folks that are wrestling with this disorder. Symptoms that you won't, and the reason people are are exhibiting these symptoms is because of what's referred to as intrusive thoughts that relate to the trauma itself. This gets back to my opening comment about loss of authority over memory. People don't make the decision to think about or obsess about these events. It's as if one is in a room with a television on, except the volume is on high. Mm-hmm. And so the flickering images and the noise of that television set is demanding people's attention. And so that's one way to think about mm-hmm. these intrusive thoughts. Now, out of public view, other symptoms that people who are struggling with PTSD will suffer are sleep disturbances, nightmares, substance abuse, which then creates its own set of problems mm-hmm. over time, and sometimes there's the struggle with suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge collection of problems, of difficulties to struggle with.
Yeah. That, you know, the suicidal ideation, you know, and suicide itself is really a self-harm. Is there also the other side of it, which is being more violent or being more harmful outwardly toward other people?
Yes, and that's what drove me into treatment years ago, was the recognition that I was potentially harmful to myself and others.
And now you were in special forces.
Yes.
Were you not?
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And David, when you came back from, just launching onto that, when you came back from Vietnam, how long was it after you came back from Vietnam that you actually sought out treatment?
Maybe 14 years. Yeah. Because I was of the opinion that I was doing well, and it didn't take the symptoms that eventually forced me into treatment didn't manifest themselves right away. And during that 10 or 12 years, I was looking pretty good in terms of living an accomplished life. Went back to school on the GI Bill, went back into the Army, had been very successful in what I was doing, had actually gotten into a master's program. And so I was the epitome of the individual that could pull themselves up by their bootstraps. All of this worked to my disadvantage. Mm-hmm. When it came time to think about, much less approaching someone to say, my life's out of control. Mm-hmm. I need some help here.
Mm-hmm. And is David, for you, is David's story kind of, is that profile just kind of
yes.
classic for you in terms of what you see with veterans that you're working with?
I do, yes. I think especially I've noticed the Vietnam era veterans specifically that because of, you know, the uncertainty at that time regarding mental health issues in general and how some veterans were treated when they returned, that it really created a lot of stigma related to mental health and accessing services as well, which, you know, I think continues to happen at a certain level, even with the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. But I'm hoping that the time frame is continuing to get less and less in order to access services. And additionally, I just, you know, I think the social isolation and avoidance tendencies off of what you were discussing regarding symptoms, I think are two that play a huge role in the ability to recognize when it's gone too far and when it's time for getting help or how to access that. And that social isolation, not even knowing who is going to support you or if you're deserving of that support. And I think that's one of the things I noticed with veterans that I talked to is almost this feeling of, you know, I think that personal belief system that they're struggling with, that identity that they've lost, and how to, you know, how that develops into this, I don't even deserve the help. I don't even. I think that's kind of what I've noticed.
You know, is there an element to that in terms of for veterans in wartime of activities that they've been involved in the war itself, the violence there, what they're feeling culpable for, that comes back to, I don't deserve to be treated any better than this. I don't.
That's a huge point. But before we get too much further, I think it would be helpful to talk about this disorder, as all disorders, as being a continuum.
Okay.
And the VA produced a handbook for clinicians back in 1987 in which they identified a model based on three variables that help sort of think about where somebody is on that continuum. And the first variable is age. So individuals that are exposed to traumatic incidents when they are younger are not going to do as well as individuals that are older. Mm-hmm. And part of this reason is because adolescents are extremely idealistic. Mm-hmm. They also don't have the resources or the life experience to be able to cope with challenging experiences. Mm-hmm. The second variable is exposure, which means that a single exposure is going to have less of an impact than multiple exposures mm-hmm. over time.
Or continued.
So mm-hmm. so as the tours started to accumulate mm-hmm. for service members going back to Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. I became very anxious. And I don't think we know what the price is as a culture for years to come.
Wow.
With that. Mm-hmm. The last variable is social support. Mm-hmm. So that individuals who have no social support system, who have experienced a lot of trauma at a young age are going to look a lot worse than somebody who has been exposed to trauma when they were older.
Mm-hmm.
The exposure was not as intense or severe over time, and who has a support system.
Yeah.
So I just think that's important that we're not talking about
right.
about one set of symptoms. And
right.
I mentioned there's quite a number of symptoms.
Yeah.
So that somebody may be struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, but they may be doing fairly well, as opposed to somebody who doesn't have as many resources. And this is going to have a huge impact on a person's willingness to come forward to seek help.
Well, yes. and you know, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems as though with our current engagement in foreign countries and the way that we're militarizing that, we're sending the same individuals back multiple times
yes.
now
yeah.
where that's really new. I mean, we haven't done that in other...
Well, we have, and it was one reason...
Have we as much?
It was
okay.
one reason I didn't stay on active duty initially was I wasn't willing to go back to do a second tour in Vietnam. But for the service members who had made a career,
right.
That's exactly what they were looking at. And if you were in an airborne unit, you were going back.
Yeah.
So it's existed in the past, but this is actually, it's unconscionable
yeah.
what we have done to these individuals.
Well, I'm going to, real quickly, while you sit with that for just a minute, David, you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org, part of the NPR Digital Network. I'm talking with David Dorfmeyer, a Vietnam veteran, retired Army Sergeant Major, and clinical therapist with personal and professional experience with PTSD, and Liv Graves, mental health therapist at San Luis Obispo County Behavioral Health, and spouse of U.S. Army combat veteran. We're also talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, sometimes referred to as an affliction of the soul. And joining us in probably about 10 minutes, we'll have Michael Young, who's the team leader of the SLOVET Center here in San Luis Obispo. Central Coast Voices is a participatory show, and your voice is important to lend itself here. If you have experience with today's topic or have a comment or question for the guest today, you can call at 781-3875. And David, you were...
Well, I think it's important to talk about recognizing some of the symptoms, which we have,
right.
And what somebody might look like depending upon where they fall on the continuum. But the other thing that is frequently missed in programs like this is, what's the road to recovery look like?
Yeah.
What's the ideal for somebody to become at peace, if that's at all possible? And I would argue that there's no such thing. I think what happens is with awareness.
There's no such thing as coming to peace.
Yeah. No. There's no such thing as being totally freed of the trauma experience itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think if one undertakes some self-awareness through a variety of different venues and or treatment, what happens is that volume on that television set can turn down, but the images will still be there.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what one hopes to do, one hopes to desensitize the emotional component of the event. And that is best done through working with a therapist or talking to a loved one, somebody who can embody some of the ideal qualities that a therapist would have, which is being non-judgmental, as you can well imagine, that is huge. And being able to gently confront the faulty thinking that we all have that sort of puts us in the position of evaluating ourselves as having failed, because there's this idealized self that we all have, and soldiers have this to the extreme. Mm-hmm. And then there's the real behavior, and the discrepancy between the two typically is what puts people in a bind. And the bind is typically referred to as survivor guilt. And that involves feeling responsible for sins of omission and commission. Soldiers have this idealized sense of how they're going to react under fire. And when it doesn't happen, they feel like they failed.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't happen and somebody dies because of that, then they feel even worse.
Mm-hmm. Is it also that something happens, they didn't contribute to it, and they end up owning that somehow?
It's a long process for a person to be able to come to recognize what their piece in mm-hmm. the whole experience is. If I can tell you one story that I heard from a soldier coming back on his second deployment, and he came in to see me, and he said, "I'm not so concerned about what happened this past go around, but I'm still bothered by an event that happened earlier." And on an earlier deployment, he was manning a 50 caliber machine gun on a perimeter when he saw three Iraqis unload an 81 millimeter mortar, and they were setting up to fire on the compound. He called back to the Tactical Operations Center, asked for permission to open fire. Permission was denied. The insurgents, if you will, had very carefully put themselves between the base and a village so that any fire would go into the village and possibly kill innocent civilians. 2 minutes later, the rounds started falling. The soldier again called for permission to open fire. Again, that was denied. 5 minutes later, after the attack had stopped, the soldier ran into the center of the compound to see what had happened, and he found a soldier bleeding out. And what he was told by another individual that was with him is that they were in a bunker once the rounds started falling, but the individual had come into the bunker not in the correct uniform. He did not have his helmet. He did not have his flak jacket with him. So the sergeant major in the bunker sent the individual back to his billeting area to get his helmet and his flak jacket so that he would be in the correct uniform. So what I attempted to tell the soldier is that there were several people that were more culpable than he was in terms mm-hmm. of that one soldier's dying. There was the battalion commander who cared more about his career than the soldiers in his base, and that's why the order was denied, allowing him to engage the three Iraqis that were setting up the 81 millimeter mortar. And then there was the sergeant major who decided that it was more important for this soldier to be in the correct uniform and send him back to his billet area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of thing that you help individuals come to understand, is that they were not totally responsible mm-hmm. For a death that they frequently feel that they have full responsibility
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm. We have a question about PTSD here from Scott. Scott, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. You had a question?
Well, as a little boy, I was sexually abused by a mother, not terribly, but and a stepfather. And I was wondering if this could contribute to a post-traumatic stress syndrome and the hampering of a personality.
Well, I mean, thanks for calling, Scott. I think that we know that there are a lot of different types of trauma, and that definitely sounds like you've experienced some pretty significant stress and trauma as a child. And yes, I mean, that can definitely affect how a person thinks and behaves over the years. But not knowing, you know, your exact situation, but it sounds like it would be helpful to talk to a therapist at some point about that.
Wow. Yeah, I've never really felt comfortable in my own skin, nor I wasn't encouraged as to develop my personality along with my peers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it probably, you know, the thing that it sounds like, Scott, that Liz was saying is it's probably a good idea to check in with someone.
Yeah, definitely, I think.
And does that answer your question, Scott?
Okay. To some degree.
Great.
I mean,
great.
It's very vague.
All
but,
right.
At the same time,
okay.
It's generalized.
Thank you, Scott. And we have, we have Michael Young joining us. And I'm going to, Michael, are you there?
I am.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
We've introduced you, and just in case people are tuning in now and don't know who you are, Michael, you are with the Slovet Center as the team leader, and you're also an adjunct lecturer here at USC and a military social worker. Have you had a chance to listen to what we've been talking about, Michael?
I have.
Okay,
I have.
Great. Glad you could join us. Are you in agreement with what we've been hearing so far?
Yes, definitely. There's always varying opinions about PTSD, and I think that's a good thing. It's always good to have a dialogue with folks from different perspectives. That's what helps us better understand what we're dealing with.
Did you want to add anything to what Liz or David were expressing about PTSD from a general sense?
Sure. Yeah. You know, oftentimes the primary focus, which maybe it should be, is on PTSD. In the Vet Center program, we try and look at each of our veterans and their family members holistically. So we do readjustment counseling, and oftentimes that very much is PTSD counseling. About 95% of our clients have a diagnosis of PTSD. But those aren't the only readjustment issues that they have. Oftentimes, as was alluded to earlier, we're talking about multiple deployments, being away from home, family stressors, financial stressors, things like traumatic brain injury, mm-hmm. and other co-occurring symptoms and disorders of PTSD that really do complicate the overall mental health picture.
And when you said that, you know, your approach, you had mentioned your approach is something different. What was the term you used?
Well, the Vet Center program is a specialized program, mm-hmm. of the Department of Veterans Affairs. And as was mentioned earlier, we do readjustment counseling.
Okay.
With war zone veterans and survivors of military sexual trauma. We also work with the family members of any veterans that were killed or lost while on active duty. And in addition to some of the more traditional or evidence-based therapies, we also try and integrate in some complementary therapies. So we include our family in the process. We do couples counseling with our families. We have a family therapist that does a significant others group. And we also try and do some things outside of the Vet Center, like encouraging our vets to come to our organic gardening group, our creative arts group, working very closely with County Behavioral Health on some of the outreach activities that they have, like kayaking and horseback riding. It's you know, when we talk about treatment for PTSD, it's really not a cookie cutter approach.
Right. Well, then a question for all three of you. Then we had kind of talked around the topic of whether or not accessing, you know, the help that is available, and we'll talk more specifically about what is available for individuals who are veterans and their families, but. Do veterans who are experiencing PTSD or having adjustment issues, do they reach out? And if not, why not? And everybody, Liz.
Okay, I'll start. I think I'm going to go back to when David was talking about social support, because I think that this does play a role in how possible it might be to, or how it might encourage or not encourage people to get the support that they might need. I think that, you know, for a lot of our veterans, they tend to really have a difficult time understanding what's going on or recognizing that things are getting worse. And if there's not people around them that are pointing some of those things out or able to encourage other avenues besides just taking care of it themselves, that I think that plays a big part in how likely they might access. And also, I mean, I think that I think Mike mentioned a little bit about substance abuse, and for a lot of veterans, I think that this really impacts the ability to really recognize when there might be something more going on, and that, you know, might need to make a change.
Do you see individuals, Liz, coming in for services that you provide that tend to be driven in because there are issues that are brought to their attention because there's a crisis within the family? It's, you know, you need to do this or...
Yeah, I think that happens quite often, at least from my perspective. And I think it varies. I think it varies dependent on the age of the veteran as well. I think that sometimes things have been happening for a very long time. And so it becomes, you know, there's even more reluctance at times after. And then also, I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't have a statistic on how sure. often that happens, but I definitely think that plays a part.
Yeah. Mike, what's your perspective on that?
Well, it's definitely an issue getting folks to come in. It's I think there are a number of reasons why. Some of it's stigma, some of it's fear, some of it's anxiety. What we try and do is take a proactive approach to that as much as we can. Part of our mission is to do outreach and education as well. So we have a dedicated outreach worker along with the rest of our staff that goes to, whether it be our local colleges, universities, to our homeless veteran stand downs, participate in our veterans treatment courts, and just go to community events that may attract veterans, so that we have every opportunity to get the word out so that they don't have to come in the event of a crisis. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, we go and do pre- and post-deployment briefings up at our local bases, Camp San Luis Obispo, Fort Hunter Liggett, Camp Roberts, Vandenberg. We try as much as we can to really get the word out, because we don't want to see people coming in because they're going through a divorce or they've gotten involved in law enforcement or they're in crisis. If we can get them in early, we can do a lot of really, really good work with them to help prevent those things from happening.
Does everybody who's returning back stateside go through some kind of a post-deployment briefing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And David, you had mentioned before when we were talking that you were involved in, as a contractor with the military, that you went to different bases where you were working with
right.
returning vets or
right.
returning
right.
active duty.
Right. Right. I was a consultant for 4 years. I worked with a company that had the contract to serve as an adjunct at different bases throughout the United States. And I've been involved in a number of those pre-deployment and post-deployment briefings. I also know that a lot of the guys will say whatever they need to say to get out of the process and get home.
Mm-hmm.
And typically what we see is a 45 to 90 day honeymoon period,
mm-hmm.
and before things start to unravel. And
what do you mean by that, before things start to unravel?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of fantasy that builds up when one is overseas in a combat zone about how different life will be once one is back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the discrepancy between what actually occurs versus the fantasy takes some time to play out. And so what one might find when they come back is there's been an affair on both parts,
mm-hmm.
That money that was sent home has been squandered,
mm-hmm.
and not available. the biggest
life is different.
Life,
I mean,
is
relationships
different. And,
are different.
And here, this is the biggest dynamic that I used to see in working with couples all the time, is that the service member, who is typically male, will deploy, and the spouse takes on a tremendous responsibility keeping the family together, and the husband will come back and will undercut her power by expecting to be able to step back into the family and then start, if not assume, all decision-making responsibilities. And so once that starts to happen, if it does, then the couple starts to fight and to argue. And invariably, that leads to domestic violence incidents or things are able to hold together until the next deployment. And I might add, it's not uncommon for military marriages to exist for 10 or 15 years because the spouse is out of the home most of the time. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon for the service member to finally retire, and within 6 months after the retirement, the marriage falls apart, mm-hmm. because they just can't tolerate, mm-hmm. being in close proximity to each other for a long period of time. And oh, by the way, they don't know each other anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like, does it work to say we're available, come and see us?
It's the politically correct thing, mm-hmm. to say. A lot of people are saying it. The chain of command within the military is on board with that. But the military culture is so resistant. The combat arms community is so resistant to asking for help. And these guys will die in order to maintain this image of themselves and to be able to maintain their identity with the group.
What do you think of that statement, Mike?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think it's one of the things that we really try and do is go out and educate the community to include our active duty guard and reserve stakeholders about the importance of this, and that we're there to partner with them, and that we'll do whatever we can to help them and with their membership. And it's a huge problem, and we see veterans every day that should have and could have gotten treatment earlier and avoided a number of the issues that they're now dealing with.
Mike, I'm going to do a station identification. I'm going to drop you off because we've got some calls that are trying to come in to ask questions, and then we're going to try and pick you back up. But I want you to please say how individuals can both the veteran or their dependents get a hold of you to try and initiate services, and if so, how do they do that?
They can call us directly at 805-782-9101. They can also come into the Vet Center. We're located at 1070 Southwood Drive in the city of San Luis Obispo.
And are there similar services that are available in Santa Barbara County and in Monterey County?
There are. So we have the nearest Vet Center to our south is Ventura, and they cover southern Santa Barbara County. We cover northern Santa Barbara County. And then to our north, the Santa Cruz Vet Center covers the majority of Monterey County, but we help out with the southern portion. So the three of our teams work very closely together, and we set up satellite locations to help our veterans better access care, as well as use contract providers to make sure that veterans can receive care right in their own backyard.
And so if we're going to be talking more about how individuals who are, you know, really a part of these individuals' lives who are suffering from PTSD, how they can reach out. But just to reiterate, those individuals can reach out to you as well to try and initiate some kind of assistance. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. And again, that number is 805-782-9101. 9101 here in San Luis Obispo. And you're open Monday through Friday, Mike?
We're open Monday through Friday. We have extended hours as well. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we're open from 8 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., and we're working real hard to extend our times beyond that as well. We want to make sure that our veterans that are working, going to school, have family care issues, can come in after hours, before hours if they need to.
Okay, and a lot of the services, you've got a plethora of services, so really encourage that people will look those up online also, correct?
Absolutely, yes, and they can go online to www.vetcenter.va.gov, and we also have a 24/7 combat call center at 1-877-WAR-VETS. That's 1-877-WARVETS, and that's always available, again, 24/7. If there's a veteran or family member out there and we don't happen to be open, there's someone on the other line that has been there, done that, and can help you out.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Mike. I know you're in between a lot of appointments and you couldn't come into the studio, but I sure appreciate you calling in.
Thank you so much.
David wanted to say something before you.
Well, you will hear this regardless, but I just wanted to say how important the Vet Center is, that I personally went through 18 months of treatment back in the 80s through the Denver Vet Center, and I have the highest regard for the team leader and the staff, and it was a struggle. I was there for a long time before I developed a comfortableness with asking for help, had it not been for the Vet Center, who knows whether I would have persevered or not. But they were the people that were there for me, and so I have a soft spot in my heart for the 300 Vet Centers that are open across this country.
Well, thank you, and thanks for that. And I think you have a number one fan here, Mike.
Well, thank you, David. Okay. I appreciate that. You know, our best marketing is always our veterans that have been through the Vet Center program. So I really do appreciate that, and I appreciate David. I know both David and Liz well, and they're doing great work in our community. So it really is a community effort, and thank you all, and thank you for having me today.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Bye. And you are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, streaming live on the web at kcbx.org. With me this first half hour have been David Dorfmeyer, Vietnam veteran, retired Army Sergeant Major and clinical therapist, Liz Graves, who's a mental health therapist at the San Luis Obispo County Behavioral Health, and also has personal experience, as she's the spouse of a U.S. Army combat veteran. And we just heard from Michael Young, who is the team leader at the San Luis Obispo County SLO Vet Center. And we've been talking about PTSD. And if you're just now joining us and you want to hear this show in its entirety, you can do so by going to our website at kcbx.org and using the drop-down menus. All of our local shows here on KCBX are archived for your listening convenience. It's just one of the many features of our new website, and really encourage you to check it out. And we have a call right now who's been very patient. And John,
hello?
Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, you had a question or comment, and thank you for being patient.
Sure, yeah, I appreciate this program, and especially David's thing about the pervasiveness of it in this culture and our society in general. I'm wondering about the specifics of how treatment takes place. I personally have a son that's been diagnosed with PTSD. He's been terrorized by it. He's terrorized me and the family, and I think I've got PTSD now. Mm. But I'm wondering, what is the specifics of treatment? Turning down the volume of the TV or what? He's taken to self-medicating.
He's taken to
sleep.
It, yeah.
And then that's caused all kinds of problems. And yeah. I mean, it's sort of a mess, you know? And the bureaucracy of getting him on disability, and you know, and so that he can kind of address these things without being terrorized by life's daily experiences, is just completely ridiculous. And and I don't think any more drugs are going to do him any good. I'm really not seeing a lot of encouragement there. I wonder, what is it, talk therapy, trying to show him how to turn down the volume? I wonder, how do you specifically do that?
Okay, you sound like a caring dad, and we're going to see if they can answer that question for you.
Yeah, well, boy, where to begin with this? First off, if he's seen a doctor, in all likelihood, that is just for medication that'll address some of the symptoms, but it doesn't really get to the root cause.
Right.
And the root cause needs to occur with not necessarily a trained clinician, because caring individuals exist in this community and have existed all through time before folks like myself ever went to graduate school. But your son has to make a decision as to whether he wants to get his act together. And that is a hard thing, I'm sure, for you to hear. And I don't say that to you lightly. But we all have that responsibility to take care of ourselves. And as a clinician, I always have to think that we do what we do in our lives because it works for us. And so one of the unanswered questions regarding your son is, what kind of investment does he have in keeping himself in limbo? And the turning down the volume was a metaphor for what happens after doing the hard work. And the hard work takes place when one starts to look at their own behavior, how they have sort of set themselves up by maybe some faulty thinking. I certainly did that. I was an idealist, still am, but not as severe. And so part of my being able to come to grips with some of the experiences that I had was developing a realistic sense as to what was my part, what could I have done, what was beyond my control, my own capabilities, and can I forgive a whole host of characters that I thought were responsible for my finding myself in the situations that I did. And folks who are traumatized typically have problems with people in positions of authority. And this stems from the company commander, the sergeant. It could be parents. It could be teachers who were responsible for the belief systems that we sort of absorbed in the process of growing up. And that's what gets challenged when we experience a traumatic event. It's like the belief that we had about ourselves, who we were, and where we are, how things work in the world, all that gets turned upside down. And so one way of thinking about recovering from traumatic experiences is that we have to reweave the fabric of our lives, and that's a long-term process.
Okay. And we lost John. We were getting some feedback from that, so we lost John, but hopefully he's hearing that. Liz, did you have something to add about the actual treatment?
Just briefly. I mean, I think that there are specific treatments out there, especially therapeutic treatments with a therapist one-on-one, but also group support that can be available just in general. And, you know, I feel for John. I mean, it's a very difficult and scary place to be with a family member who's suffering so much and, you know, feeling helpless in and of yourself to be able to do anything about it. And so at times it's just the small steps that we can take, even just the safety planning and the, you know, the support, even if that means, you know, setting really strong boundaries as a family with what's going to be acceptable and what's not.
Yeah. I've had friends whose spouses, both female spouses and male spouses, have been in the military, been deployed, and have come back. And, you know, the comment that has come from both is that it's not the same person for me. You know,
yeah.
I'm not It's not who I knew. Do you hear that, or is it?
Yeah, I think I hear that quite often, and I think I've had those thoughts in my head as
and
a spouse of a veteran.
And I was going to ask you about that.
You know, that's a very difficult thing to even feel as a loved one of someone who's suffering so much. And, you know, I think that a lot of veterans themselves would say they don't even feel like the same person and that they never will be. And, you know, that's something, you know, when they're ready to really talk about that is when some of the healing can start. Because I think that, you know, there comes a point as family members that we just can't watch it anymore. And everything that we try doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's really about the veteran making the decision to do something else.
Is it important in situations like that for individuals who do feel different and for families who feel the person is different to establish a new relationship with that new individual? I mean, because it doesn't seem like you could go back to the old relationship.
Yeah.
I don't think you can, mm-hmm. and I think this gets back to the integration between the idealized versus the real self, mm-hmm. and that is a big component of treatment.
Uh-huh.
And I might add that there's a good book that I'd like to recommend for both the individuals and family members, and that was a book that was published about 5 or 10 years ago, more like 10 years ago, called War in the Soul by Edward Tick. And Tick worked for 30 years with Vietnam veterans, was very disappointed with his success, took a sabbatical, looked at all the literature across many cultures, and came back with what I think is a pretty healthy approach that has a very strong spiritual component to it. And that's the healing part, is to replace innocence with wisdom, to embrace forgiveness, mm-hmm. to achieve inner peace, and to start to see oneself as having something to contribute to society. Mm. And this taps into Joseph Campbell's work with the hero's adventure, and that's a model that I used to use, and it works for anybody that is coming back from just a really difficult life experience. It talks about how do you integrate what you have learned with the community mm-hmm. that has launched you,
mm-hmm.
and so I would encourage John and other family members who are hoping to gain some insight as to what their veterans have gone through, and also for the veterans themselves to read Edward Tick's book.
Okay. And I love that, to replace innocence with wisdom, mm-hmm. because there is a loss of innocence in whether it's
Definitely.
Whether it's a childhood trauma, whether it's, you know, whether it's a rape, whether it's a wartime experience.
Yeah, I think just that transformation that can happen, transforming trauma into something positive, mm-hmm.
eventually,
can
even if
can,
it's I learned and I survived,
right,
and I'm moving forward and I'm healing,
right. And as a mm-hmm. family, we're creating this new phase of life, which includes my traumatic experience.
And we got one call here. Hi, you're on the line. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You had a question?
Hi. I had just a comment about getting financial assistance from the Veterans Administration for PTSD.
You know, Nancy, the person to ask for that would be the Veterans Administration, because the
actually, it's not a question. It's a statement.
Okay.
The love of my life came back from Vietnam severely damaged in 1971. And he was one of the first guys in 1987 to actually get the diagnosis from the VA of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the next 30 plus years, the VA continually over and over and over again denied him any disability, saying he had no PTSD. And I could never understand how they could diagnose him with it at a VA hospital in Loma Linda and then deny him a claim. And finally, in 2000, with the assistance of the Veterans Services Officer at the Veterans Hall in San Luis, we filled out the forms yet one more time. And in 2005, they finally sent him a letter and said that in 1987, I quote, an egregious error was made when they completely ignored all of the doctor's input. And they gave him back pay in 2005 to 1987.
Well, it's really good to know that you got that kind of support locally. And I'm sure if Mike is still listening, he'll be very pleased to hear that the center that he's working with was able to do that. So thank you for calling and sharing that.
So tell them, don't give up.
Okay. Yeah, perseverance. Thank Bye-bye. You, Nancy. We have about 5 minutes left in this show, so we're not going to take any more calls. But I do want to make sure that we take enough time to give information about what resources are available here. So if you can talk a little bit about the services available that you're aware of, Liz, through County Mental Health and other resources, the different programs, please do share that.
Sure, no problem. So County Mental Health or County Behavioral Health has started a particular program to serve veterans and their families, which is where I work. And what we do is we are able to do outreach events for veterans and their families in the community that are really physically active and rehabilitative in order to educate people about what mental health services are available and how to access them. We also have at the Veterans Service Office through the county is which where my office is located. Those representatives there are very supportive of veterans and helping them obtain benefits and services and you know, find out what's available because it can be a complicated system to navigate at times. And also we have a program, the Veterans Treatment Court program, which has started about a year ago, which helps veterans who have been involved in the criminal justice system and are struggling with mental health conditions related to their military service. And so this has been a very successful program for veterans to work through those mental health struggles and obtain the support that they deserve. So, and additionally, I'm a therapist through this program and I'm able to see combat, non-combat veterans and their family members and really additionally link them with services through even medical services as well, because I think, like Mike had mentioned, the holistic approach of veterans also need that medical support, the emotional support, the family support, and the community support in general. So that's kind of what we have going on right now.
Real quickly, David, we have about a minute.
Sorry.
I would encourage people to go online to the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder to find out information about the disorder and resources. There's a National Veterans Crisis Hotline at 800-273-8255. I personally use the County of San Luis Obispo Veterans Service Office to file my claim, and while it did take 5 years, ultimately the VA adjudicated 6 service-related injuries for me. Their number is 805-781-6766.
Okay, and I'm going to need to go ahead and cut you off, but also San Luis Obispo hotline at 800-783-0607. I want to thank my guests today, David Dorfmeyer, Liz Graves, and Michael Young for joining me on today's show about PTSD. Next week, Fred Monroe and his guests will be talking about the understanding the complex world of campaign finance and its implications for policymaking on the Central Coast. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities, the San Luis Foundation, and KCBX. If you have comments about today's show or comments regarding future shows, voices@kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.